Today's program has been brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit internationalculinarycenter.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning and welcome to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, and every Wednesday at 11 o'clock we have a conversation about, well, it's my favorite subject. I hope it's yours. I don't know why you'd be listening if it wasn't, but we talk about taste. And this is one of our special edition shows that is we're doing in conjunction with the James Beard Foundation's annual food conference. And the theme of the conference this year, which was held in October in New York, was the paradox of appetite. And to discuss those paradoxes and appetite and sort of the interconnectedness of what we want and what we have and how we choose to eat, we invited a terrific roster of experts on various aspects of those issues and more from around the world. And with me today, we're so fortunate to have Raj Patel, who was one of those guests for the conference. And you may know Raj, who, I don't know, do we say you're an activist or an author? You like both?
It's true.
You are both an activist and author. You may have read Stuffed and Starved or The Value of Nothing, the names of which I think give away perhaps his perspective to some extent on the global food scene. Thank you for joining us for this conversation.
It's great to be here, Mitchell.
So let's just start. Tell us a little bit. You've been working. I know that you're here in the midst of working on a sort of global documentary about the food system, trying to look at some things I think that we don't often see, certainly not in America when we're talking about food and thinking about, you know, how evil maybe some of our companies are or how no one eats together or those sorts of things. But you're trying to show us a whole different aspect of the food system, I think, that is often unseen. Tell us about the project.
So the project is called Generation Food, and yes, I mean, we're going to places like Okinawa or Fukushima, or you know, just to pick two places in Japan, or we're doing a lot of work in Malawi, we're trying to do work in India and Peru and Italy, and also in the United States, but finding stories not of what is wrong with the global food system, about which I think we have an abundance of evidence, but rather what people are doing to fix it. And not as a kind of cosmetic fixes, but actually some really deep structural changes that people are trying to make happen. It's a real sort of privilege to be going around and finding these kinds of deep solutions to problems in the global food system. So, for example, in Okinawa, Okinawa is a super interesting place. It's the place where there are still the world's largest number of people who live to 100 years old, right, as a proportion of the population. And yet they are burying their grandchildren. If you look at the sort of demographic curve, it's actually one of the saddest curves in the world, right? Because you have all these elderly people who are living, who are outlasting their grandkids because of these dramatic changes in diet, because of the arrival of the U.S. military and the base that was there. And of course, when the U.S. initially came to Okinawa, no one was happier to see them than the Okinawans, right? They'd been starved by the Japanese mainlanders. It was a horrific conflict. And unfortunately, the food that came with the U.S. forces was food that the U.S. forces wanted, and that was, you know, wheat noodles. I mean, look out for wheat noodles as a kind of stormtrooper of dietary change everywhere in the world. It's really interesting. Like, you see it in India now. The Maggi noodles, the Maggi noodles, a really interesting example of how new foods are introduced as convenience foods, as foods of the future, as foods that are about care and reciprocity and kindness to kids. And that's what these foods were initially brought into Okinawa, and so you have the sort of eradication of the Okinawan diet, the traditional Okinawan diet. And so some people are saying, well, you know, the way back from this is we need the traditional Okinawan diet back. And the trouble is, there's no traditional Okinawa to have that diet in. right? I mean, so you have the ingredients, but you're losing a lot of the culture because almost everything about Okinawa has changed. The geography, the best land for growing food in Okinawa now has a large U.S. airstrip on it. So how do you tackle that? Well, some people are saying, well, you know, you need vegetable deliveries to the elderly, and you know, obviously that's a great way of getting over some of these hurdles. But some people are saying, well, you probably want the military to bugger off, and then we can start farming again. And that's a much deeper solution, it seems to me, than merely to encourage people to eat the right things. Mm. To actually alter the physical geography, the tempo, the economic possibilities of how it is that you get to eat better and build community. To talk about land reform as a way of improving your diet is, I think, a much deeper way of thinking than merely to say, here's a book of recipes, you can cook this by yourself at home, why don't you go, you know, go ahead and do it Okinawa, which is what some people have said.
A lot of people do. No, and I think it speaks to a couple of things that we keep hearing as related to these issues, and that is there's a group, certainly in America, that wants to look back. You know, everyone should be growing their own things or cooking their own things, and it seems so not just anti-progress, because progress is in quotes, but also implausible that anyone will go back to something, but instead, I think, creating a model to go forward to that may be based on the values that from the past or something. Mm-hmm. It sounds like they're trying to find themselves in the future rather than sort of go back to something before time, before the Americans were there, let's say.
So, consider the word peasant, for example, which...
Great word.
That's it, right?
It isn't the food community.
Outside, of course, you know, I mean, when Wall Street was selling policies, insurance policies on employees, do you know the story about... So, Wall Street was selling companies, insurance policies on their employees, and when the employee died, the company, not the employee's family, would get the money, and those were called dead peasant policies, where the idea being that these workers, these proletarians, were just basically peasants, and when they died, the company would be better off. The word peasant is in the English language something that's hopelessly backward, right? You know, right. It's sort of back to a day when people chewed straw and had bad teeth. And what's interesting is that you have this international peasant movement, La Via Campesina, the peasant way. Right. And there are more and more people who are proudly calling themselves peasants. I was just in Maine talking to the raw milk crowd out there. And they're quite happy to call themselves peasants. And to hear that in an American accent is... It's startling, but what's interesting is that it's a reappropriation. I mean, in the same way that queer, I mean, it's an important word. It initially has nothing to do with gay politics, then it becomes a slander, and then it becomes something very progressive. Mm-hmm. And peasant has undergone that sort of transformation as well. And I think when initially people hear the word peasant, they're like, oh, that's backward, and you know, it's about bad teeth. And in fact, what it is about is women's rights, about land reform, around taste, right, around joy, around pleasure, around democracy. And these are very 21st century mm-hmm. ideas and not 19th.
Mm-hmm. So give us another example. Let's leave Japan, because I know you have been to so many incredible places. Let's go to Malawi and what you saw there.
So what I presented at this conference was a story about ending malnutrition. Now, everyone wants to end malnutrition.
No, I don't. I want to keep it.
but if you look at what the new Alliance for Food Security and Nutrition, this is something that the G8 country, the Group of Eight countries, has come out with. Mm-hmm. And the vision was, we're going to end malnutrition. We're going to lift 50 million people out of poverty by the year 2020. And of course, the irony is, this is coming from the U.S. government, where there are 50 million people who are food insecure in the United States. But we're not worrying about the U.S. We're worrying about Africa. They're much worse off over there, you see. This plan to end malnutrition, and what they want to do is, if you look at the Malawian manifesto, it's, we will make sure that companies can buy Malawian land, we will make sure that they will get their money out, that there is a good banking system, that there is low taxes, and that the labor force is mobile, so workers' rights are not paramount. And somehow, there is one provision to end malnutrition, which is that if you are a woman who has a full-time job in Malawi, your maternity leave will go from 4 to possibly 6 weeks. And that will be the... And so you see how absurd that is, but nonetheless, you know, what looks like it's a manifesto...
Sounds good, right, yes.
For malnutrition is actually about prolonging... about making it easier for companies to sell their wares in Malawi. However, in northern Malawi, there's a really interesting project that comes out of a hospital people. And in the year 2000, there's, you know, I mean, life expectancy was 52 years old. HIV/AIDS prevalence was 12 to 13%. And they wanted to end malnutrition. So you do that by increasing the diversity of crops. But you have to, you know, no one has the expertise to grow soybeans next to millet, next to cowpea. And so, and there's no money to teach. So instead, they develop a farmer-to-farmer network where every farmer became a scientist. So they stopped being, you know, these recipients of the magic beans from Monsanto or from the government. And instead, they became their own research network. And so you have 5,000 Malawian farmers becoming really good farmer researchers. And they figure out ways in which they exchange knowledge together, which is, you know, those networks are incredibly important. And then they find themselves with a couple of problems. One problem is that they've got, you know, cowpea and millet and sorghum and soybeans. Soybeans are a great crop, but no one knows what the hell to do with them. I mean, you know, it's a mystery. It's like kale. Though, of course,
figured it out.
Yes, not to the listeners of the Heritage Radio Network, who, of course, know exactly what to do with kale. But cast your mind back before. And also you have a different problem, which is that it's possible for there to be more food in the fields and for there to be increased malnutrition, because harvesting is women's work. And if women are harvesting and cooking and cleaning and fetching firewood and breastfeeding, then if there's more harvesting to do, then the breastfeeding goes down. So the farmers fix this problem, and it was actually suggested by one of the men in this farmer research network, which is to say, look, let's cook together. And so they figure out how to cook together, and through this cooking together, women and men cooking together, they turn it into a sort of public event. It's very joyful, it's very pleasurable. Men are recognized as equals, but also women are recognized as equals. And it becomes a way in which you can fight sexism, patriarchy. In Malawian villages, that's a problem. I mean, obviously in the US it's a problem too. You know, this is a country where women get 70% for every dollar that men get. We don't have to pretend the patriarchy is just in Africa. But that's what's interesting about this story, is that if you want to fight malnutrition, and malnutrition in these villages has now been observed to go down to zero, and that's a much better result than the New Alliance has, you know, is ever dreaming of. But it's been done not through selling Monsanto's products or fertilizer, but getting farmers as educators and farmers as agents of social change within their own communities, and that's a radical new idea, I think.
I'm curious. You've described two experiences of change, obviously at really the ground level, the grassroots level. Have you seen any examples of it coming from the top, from a corporate awakening that we sometimes read about? I know Walmart apparently had one, and suddenly we're supposed to believe that everything they're doing is trying to change the way that they do business and what they represent. In any of the examples you have?
Well, I mean, I know that there are, if you imagine a sort of 2x2 grid of things that are good for the corporation and bad, and good things that are good for a community and bad. I think some of the interesting awakenings that we've heard a lot about are around companies doing things that are good for the company and for a community, right? So when Walmart realizes, hey, you know, we can fight climate change by reducing our energy expenditure, that's good for the planet, that's good for Walmart, right? Because they're spending less on gas. Similarly, if you're working, if you're putting toilets into where your plantation workers are, that's great because no one wants plantation workers getting diarrhea, and the plantation workers are happy that they have to wade through poo. I mean, it's great. I mean, it works for everyone. The trouble is that some of the bigger gains are ones that are outside the good for the company, good for the community, you know, square. So, for example, things that are good for a community but bad for a company, I mean, things that involve land reform, that involve restrictions on marketing, those kinds of things, you don't see corporations quite so enthusiastic about it. And, you know, and I think, you know, we've both had these kinds of conversations where we'll talk to a sustainability person from a company, and they're often the nicest people in that corporation because they understand they need to be, you know, fighting the good fight. But their corporation will also be pushing forward some very unsustainable agendas. And if by night we were to have drinks with these sustainability people, they would say, look, Jesus, please just regulate us. For the love of God, regulate us, because we won't do it ourselves. But by day, they're like, no, we are good corporate citizens. Right. And it's, you know, there are things that you could pick out, and, you know, you could say Unilever's doing this or Coca-Cola's doing that. But in general, I think some of the important gains happen not coming from corporations' beneficence, but because things are taken from corporations.
Right. Well, and this is one of the issues that I find I keep coming up against in some of these conversations, is that they'll only be good for the company in a market structure until that that market collapses, and then they're not good for anybody from the company's perspective because there's no gain to be had.
Right.
If everyone's not paying more for gas, suddenly there's a gas problem, the opposite gas problem. It's not a shortage, it's a glut, and then the whole world stops. Let's come to the U.S. You've described two interesting stories. What do you see, and again, I keep asking these unfair questions of my guests, but from your vast exposure to these, both the problems and some of the solutions that you've seen, what do you think is the issue that Americans ought to be thinking about right now in terms of their food and the impact that the decisions that we make have on others and also on ourselves? Is there something that stands out that, whether we're addressing it or people are talking about it or not?
Well, I mean, I think the key issue everywhere in the world when it comes to food is poverty. Now, you know, that may not sound like the be-all and end-all, but
it's not something I think we normally think of here in America, that's part of the problem of the food situation is poverty.
And of course it is. I mean, when you look at the fact that there are 50 million people. I mean, I was in Italy yesterday talking to farmers, you know, small farmers from peasant associations from across the country, and they were gobsmacked that there were 50 million Americans who were food insecure. They just couldn't believe it. And if we're serious about good food for everyone, we need to understand the dynamics that drive, you know, that drive this sort of vicious spiral down. And it's low. I mean, cheap food in America has been cheap food and cheap gas is the corollary to low wages in the United States. If we're serious about building and rebuilding a food culture, about having the time to cook from scratch, I mean, I think that's a terrific idea. The idea of people getting around the table, cooking together, sharing a meal, I think that's a fantastic idea, and people should listen to the Claude Fischler podcast to understand more about that. But in order to be able to do that, how do you have the time? You need the money. How do you get the money? You need to organize around better wages. And I think that poverty is one of the reasons why our food culture is so impoverished. And I mean, it's not the only reason, but I think that for too long, cheap food has been the kind of the alibi for bad food.
But of course, let's not forget, you're talking about poverty in the richest country in the world, mm-hmm. right? So let's understand what food insecure means in the context of global hunger. What is food insecure in America?
Well, so there are a couple of definitions. Food insecurity worldwide is just not knowing that you have access to enough food at all times to lead a healthy and productive life. And in the United States, that's measured by the USDA with a panel of 10 questions around things like, were you or anyone in your family worried about being able to put food on the table? Did you ever skip a meal? Were you, you know, did you not have enough money to buy a decent balanced meal for your family? And so if you answer yes to enough of these questions, you're categorized as either food insecure or very food insecure. And it's a methodology that's pretty rigorous and robust. And it's something you can see in internationally. And people may say, well, you know, these people aren't starving. They're just worried about the food. But if you look at the costs of hunger in the United States in terms of lost productivity, in terms of days off work, in terms of lost potential, you'll find that actually the psychological impacts of hunger in the United States run to billions of dollars every year, tens of billions of dollars. This is not a trivial thing to understand food insecurity in a way of just not knowing where your next meal is coming from. Merely not knowing where your next meal is coming from, even if ultimately you get to eat, is an incredibly traumatic and destructive experience, not just for the individual, but for the community and for the society.
We're going to think about that for a moment and take a quick break. You're listening to Taste Matters. I am your host, Mitchell Davis, and I'm talking to Raj Patel, author of The Value of Nothing and Stuffed and Starved, and he's given us a lot to satisfy us for the next minute or two. Thanks.
The International Culinary Center is a proud sponsor of the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com. But you make me believe it. So do I really? Do I really want? If you could keep it together for a moment in time.
Welcome back to Taste Matters. I am talking to Raj Patel, who is the author of Stuffed and Starved and The Value of Nothing, and who's been traveling around the world working on a documentary looking for solutions to some interesting problems regarding food and the disparity of those who have and those who do not. So we left talking about food insecurity and what it means in America for people to be insecure, and I'm wondering, how then do you present a palatable way for people to understand they also have to pay more for their food in a place where people, so 55 million are insecure, which everyone seems to think, myself included, is part of the problem, is the pervasiveness of food so cheap that there's nothing in it, literally and figuratively. We're stuffed and starved.
Well, I think the way to respond to that is the way that slow food, I mean, the originators of slow food in Italy had a very good idea, which is they recognized that everyone deserves the right to pleasure. And if everyone deserves the right to pleasure, what do you need? You need time and you need money. So they unionized agricultural workers, who were at that time the lowest paid people, and so they raised their wages. And then they fought for a two-hour lunch break so people could enjoy the food. And I think that if you're interested in persuading people for the case of paying more for your food so that everyone gets, so that workers are lifted up, you have to offer as the corollary more wages. I mean, I think that raising wages in the United States is not it's not something that should be an option. It's a necessity. Particularly given the way that so many people in this country are scraping by on poverty level wages. I do think that one of the cases to be made around this is that for having more expensive food, first we need to make sure that everyone can afford to eat properly.
And it must be said that, ironically, one of the largest lobby groups against raising minimum wage is the restaurant industry.
That's
who,
right.
Because they pay the lowest and they employ the most, and the margins, I mean, to their defense, I guess it's hard to defend. The margins are pretty small in food in an interesting way for all the reasons that we talked about. So, interesting.
Exactly. I mean, the National Restaurant Association, the other NRA, yeah. As it is, as Saru Jayaraman points out in her book, Behind the Kitchen Door, rather, which is very good, I think that there are ways of being able to push back against that and to suggest that, there's a way of just contextualizing fast food. I mean, how is fast food necessary? Fast food becomes vital because of the pace of the way we live today. There is a long history of street food, but the way that fast food looks in the United States is bizarre, because all of a sudden you're feeding entire families in cars as they're going from one place to another, mm-hmm. as parents try to work to be able to secure things like healthcare and, God forbid, a pension. These things are, fast food is a kind of structural corollary of our overexploitation and our lack of time to be able to have pleasure. And joy in cooking and eating in the sort of kind of commensality that Claude Fischel talks about. So I think it's important to put fast food in its context. It's a product of modern sort of hyper-capitalist society, and it's also important to walk back from it and think, well, if we're interested in ending the sort of scourge of these kinds of the consequences of eating fast food, we need also to be thinking about working less and having more pleasure and having higher wages, and all of these are possible if you look to Europe. There are there are countries that have managed this quite well, but it requires a kind of breaking out of our imaginations of what is possible in the United States, and at the moment I think we've been rather impoverished in terms of thinking about what's possible.
Thinking about what's possible, I want to ask you an easier question, maybe. What kind of food do you enjoy? Let's start there. Like, what do you like to eat?
I have a mushroom fetish because most sensible people do. The best food and the best meals are the ones you eat round tables with friends that are sort of cooked. Some of the best meals I've had recently are just with neighbors, just round the table because we threw it together at the last minute. Mm-hmm. And in fact, this has I'm just going to go on a tangent, but it's a great tangent. Cul-de-sacs, dead-end streets. That you're 40% more likely. I live on a dead end street. You're 40% more likely to know your neighbors if you live on a dead end street. And there's this hypothesis out there that if you're interested in ending childhood obesity, kids need to be out on the street again. Now, most streets have lots of traffic in them, but You can architect, you can design ways of living in urban spaces that actually encourage the kinds of social bonds that are broken down in urban spaces by building in spaces in which neighbors get to know each other and will cook together and you're not ending up with this kind of individual, I'm going to microwave this for me and this for my kid and this for my partner, but instead we're going to sit around a big old table and just cook whatever's in the fridge. And that, those meals, I have to say, have been the ones that I've been enjoying most recently.
Hmm. It's funny, I grew up on a cul-de-sac also. Maybe there's something, and so did our producer Ashley there. So maybe there is something about ending up in the food world, right? Yes, and living on the street. Although I don't know that we shared meals with our neighbors, but we certainly played hockey because it was in Toronto, in Canada. Let's talk about this concept of appetite then, because it's the theme of the conference that brought us all here, and it's something that personally I feel in some ways defines us as Americans. We are the land of appetites, as much as Claude Fischler was talking about individualism here and the sense of entitlement we have to satisfy our individual appetites. I'm wondering what you think about how one can reconcile sort of what it means to be American and some of these issues that you've brought up, the disparity of distribution and money and poverty, and if there's a way to reconcile them, do you think?
This would be one of those harder questions that you ask.
Harder than what
kind of food do you like?
I certainly think that the idea of appetite is very individualized here, and I think Claude and I would agree there. But I think that actually, in fact, people are not as self-contained as the idea of individualism would prescribe. I mean, so much of the way that we eat and the way that we communicate and the way that our appetites come to us are social. And often that's forgotten in the United States. I mean, part of being American is the idea of I can, as an individual, do whatever I like and I can apply myself, and the way to fight obesity is to go on a diet, and the way to fight poverty is to become rich. But when you look at those individualized solutions, they're always absolutely, they depend on a certain kind of social context. I certainly see that there are ways in which social change can increase the chances of fighting obesity, and social change can increase the chance of ending poverty. But I think that, first of all, you need to organize. No one by themselves is going to fight poverty. Unless you're Bill Gates, even if you're Bill Gates, especially if you're Bill Gates, you're not going to fight it alone. So what I've seen in the United States that works quite well is, and it's a common theme actually around the world when we're filming this film, Generation Food, when we're going in lots of different places, and we find that when you get people of different generations from the same neighborhood around a table eating together and talking about politics. I mean, because again, that's one thing in America you're told, when I was here, first arrivals, don't talk about religion or politics at the dinner table. I'm like, well, then what the fuck are you going to talk about?
You can say fuck it, run internet. Yeah.
I think that actually, and in almost every culture around the world, there is a tradition of talking about politics at the dinner table, because that's what you do. You talk about, that guy, the bastard, did you just see what they're trying to do there? And all of a sudden, you use the dinner table and the joy of being around the same place at the same time as a venue for politics, and not just a venue of talking about how crappy everything is, but what you're going to do about it. And so in Detroit, there's a fantastic group called Cook, Eat, Talk. And what they do is they cook and they eat and then they talk about what it is that they, what they would like to change. It seems to me that the appetite for good food is utterly compatible with an appetite for social transformation. But you need to do it together. It's not the kind of thing that happens as a solo effort. And that, I think, is what we've been socialized into in the United States, particularly over the past few years, that if only you go to Whole Foods and buy the right things, you're okay, Jack. And social change will have happened because those workers aren't as exploited as the people who are at Safeway, for instance. And I think that there is, particularly among young people, a kind of impatience with that individualism, I'm certainly seeing it in some of the students I'm coming across, and I'm hoping that we'll be able to create more space to be able to have that discussion. So I think, yes, to answer your question, it is possible to reconcile the ideas of changing appetite and of social change, but it means dropping this individualism out of the equation.
And speaking of students, people have an opportunity to learn more from you if you aren't getting enough from this conversation. Tell us a little bit about your project. Right.
So next, in the spring, Michael Pollan and I will be teaching the Edible Education class at Berkeley, and it is a massively online, open class. So if anyone who wants to take it will be free to do so, at least that's the plan. And you'll find past lectures are available online on YouTube, and hopefully we'll have all of these up and ready for you to take in the future too.
And I am sure that if you've made it this far, you will want more of Raj Patel, as we all do. Thank you so much for being here, for being with us.
It's always a pleasure.
Talking. In the meantime, before our show next week, why don't you cook, eat, and talk, I think, do what they do in Detroit, although it doesn't seem to have solved everything in Detroit, but certainly it has helped the people who have done it. So thank you so much for listening. This is Taste Matters. I'm Mitchell Davis. We'll be here next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.